Last time we were talking about a massless scalar field on a non-dynamical FRW vector. The action is this. In conformal time. Looks like a Minkowski action with a factor of a squared. We showed that the exact solution to this free but time-dependent QFT was given in the Heisenberg picture. Or this type of functional form, where u sub phi is the mode of function, satisfying this, the same differential equation as one Fourier mode in the classical theory, with an initial condition which can't be derived from classical mechanics and requires matching to the ground state of a harmonic oscillator. So this initial condition corresponds to the statement that we want the theory to start in its vacuum state. And over time, it will get excited and fluctuations will be generated. So this is true at early times. Which means that the quantity AH, or like the inverse of the co-moving causal horizon, is much less than the wave number K. You could think of AH as being a kind of clock that grows roughly exponentially, because in the de Sitter case, H would be constant and A would be exponential. And slow roll means close to de Sitter. So that at early times, the causal horizon is much larger than the wavelength of the mode. And the mode does not feel the expansion of the universe, so to speak, and thinks that it is a free field in Minkowski space with an oscillatory mode function. And at late times, the causal horizon of the universe is much smaller than the wavelength of the mode. And different parts of the mode are no longer in causal contact. So the mode can't oscillate or evolve. And the mode function will freeze to a constant value. So at late times, meaning that the horizon AH is, or the inverse horizon is much larger than K, this mode function will approach a constant. Something which is constant in tau but can depend on K. And the late time power spectrum, which is what we'll be interested in when we get to inflation, is A squared. So if you were interested in if you had a functional form for A of tau, and you were interested in the late time power spectrum, you could compute it by looping over K and integrating this differential equation with these initial conditions. And that, for a complex expansion history, that differential equation would probably not be analytically solvable. You would want to do it on the computer. So there's a slow roll approximation to the exact solution, which is very useful, which says that, let me write it as an approximation for the power spectrum, that is the square of the mode function at late times. Um, where the star notation means evaluated at the time of horizon crossing. That is at the time when AH is equal to the wave number K of interest. Or throughout the lecture, I'll usually use the dimensionless power spectrum defined like this. It's just normalized so that its square root is the characteristic size of a fluctuation. It's our square root over 4 pi squared. Now the larger scales cross the horizon earlier. So if I had a large scale or a small value of k, and a small scale or a large value of k, then horizon crossing happens later for the smaller scale mode. And so you can think of, if I draw a different plot, namely the inflaton rolling down its potential, then if you could observe the power spectrum at late times, what you would have is sort of like an H-ometer, where for each scale k, the value of the power spectrum will tell you the value of H, or equivalently the energy density, which is almost the same thing as V in the slow roll approximation, at a point on the inflaton trajectory that is determined by the wave number k with so there'd be some range of, if there's some range of k values that is observable, which is more or less what happens at the CMB, then there's some range of time values along the inflaton trajectory where you get to observe H ordered so that the largest scales in your map correspond to earlier times or the part of the trajectory that is higher on the inflaton potential. So one thing that ought to be true is that because the inflaton rolls downhill, the value of H is decreasing. And so this power spectrum, the scale invariant power, the dimensionless power spectrum, ought to be roughly constant because this is supposed to be slow roll inflation and the inflaton is moving slowly. But to leading order, the K dependence should have a negative derivative. We ought to be going from larger H to smaller H. So let's try to prove that. So let me remind you that the definition of slow roll was that these quantities were small. And a couple of lectures ago, we showed that if the slow roll conditions were satisfied, then the equations of motion for the inflaton, the background equations of motion, could be simplified to a pair of first order differential equations, which let you relate any quantity in sight, like phi dot, phi double dot, and so on, to local derivatives of V with no need to integrate a differential equation to integrate the history. So in the slow roll approximation, let me make these. And we did a few examples, but I think we did the first two of these examples in that lecture. But I'll need a few more identities of this type, which can be derived similarly. I'm omitting the derivation because if you look at how the first two were derived in the previous lecture, the others are similar. Where the approximately equals means to leading order and slow roll parameters. I'm going to put these guys in their own blackboard that I will carefully preserve at the top, since I'm going to use these formulas a few times during the lecture. Okay, so going back to this example, if we, as an example of the use of these formulas, if we want to prove that the dimensionless power spectrum, we know it's nearly constant, the power spectrum is nearly scale invariant, but if we want to show that its leading order deviation from constantness is given by a negative derivative, then we might compute the spectral index, which is defined to be the derivative of the log of the power spectrum with respect to log k. We want to see that that's negative. So let's write that as this is strictly speaking an approximation because it's something that's only true to leading order in the slow roll. And under the slow roll approximation, the dimensionless power spectrum is just proportional to h squared. And then the star means that for a given wave number k, I evaluate h in the numerator at the point during inflation when ah is equal to k. So in other words, I'm differentiating log h with respect to log ah. This is just the definition of what horizon crossing means. Then my formulas are sort of set up for differentiating with respect to time, so let me write it this way. Then this is h dot over h. This is h plus h dot squared. No, h plus h dot. Then, according to the slow roll dictionary, this guy is minus epsilon h to lowest order and slow roll parameters. And here, the h dot is lower order and slow roll than the h. So this guy's leading order behavior is h inverse, or minus 2 epsilon. And that indeed we can see that the spectral index is always less than 0, since epsilon was defined to be the square of something, and therefore always greater than 0. So far I haven't talked about inflation where the metric is dynamical, but in this situation of a massless scalar on a non-dynamical background, you can prove that, and we have a picture that explains why, the power spectrum is nearly scale invariant, but if you look closely, slightly red. Okay. Well, let's talk about inflation. We showed, and this was mostly done in the homework, I just outlined it in the lecture, that in single field slow roll inflation, after doing all the gauge fixing and eliminating non-dynamical variables, there are 3 degrees of freedom. There's a scalar zeta and a graviton-like field with 2 degrees of freedom. And the action for the scalar, they have independent actions, and so we can analyze them independently. The action for the scalar looked like this. And the action for the gravitons look like this. So let me start by analyzing the case of the gravity waves. Each Fourier mode k can be analyzed independently, since this is a quadratic action, a quadratic translation invariant action. When if I go to Fourier space, there will be no coupling between Fourier mode k and Fourier mode k prime. For each wave number k, there are two polarizations. We have gauge conditions that say that gamma is, well, by definition, gamma was traceless, and then we had a gauge fixing condition that this partial derivative, or in Fourier space k, contracted with gamma must give zero, or gamma is sort of perpendicular to k. So, for example, in a coordinate system, where the Fourier mode k that we're analyzing points in the z direction, gamma ij of k would be a linear combination of these basis tensors. In general, for each Fourier mode k, a more coordinate system independent way of writing it. Oh, sorry, let me skip that. Come back to that. So gamma ij of k would be, in general, just a linear combination of these basis tensors with some time-dependent coefficients. A coordinate system independent way of writing it, it would be that if I square gamma, this is defined so that this is 1/2 the sum of the squares of the h's. So the 1/2 is the cosmologist normalization for gravity waves. This is just the usual h plus h times decomposition of a gravity wave. The normalizing factor of 1/2 is what is conventional in cosmology. For every Fourier mode k, there are two scalar functions, h1 and h2. In terms of those quantities, the action for the gravity waves can be written like this. There's an extra factor of 1/2. And then the contraction over tensor indices and the action just becomes a sum over polarizations S. Sum goes from 1 to 2. So I'll put in the A squared. This is exactly the same action as the non-dynamical field. Except for a factor of M Planck squared over 8. we can read off the... We can read off the gravity wave power spectrum from the case of a non-dynamical, a scalar on a non-dynamical FRW background. There's just an extra factor of 8 over m Planck squared. Remember that multiplying the action by an overall constant doesn't change the classical mechanics, but it can change the quantum mechanics. There was a relation like this. So I'm just temporarily confused by why there isn't a square here. All right. So if I change the action by an overall constant, say m Planck squared over 8, then that will change the conjugate momentum by scaling it by a factor of m Planck squared over 8. That in turn will put an m Planck squared over 8 in the canonical commutator relation. And so to absorb that, you would end up scaling the mode function by a factor of m Planck squared over 8 to the minus 1 half. So that in the power spectrum, which is the square of u, you end up just rescaling by a factor of 8 over m Planck squared. Okay. And the spectral index of the gravity waves, as we showed, gravity wave spectral index are standard term is tensor spectral index. The gravity wave mode is sometimes called a tensor mode. N sub t is minus 2 epsilon. As we showed before, the factor 8 over m Planck squared doesn't change the spectral index, of course. In single field slow roll inflation, it's sort of a theorem that... Now, gravity waves haven't been observed in the CMB yet. They we have an upper bound on their amplitude. They may or may not be there at a lower level. Because the Hubble constant of inflation could be large or small. But if they are there, then it's sort of a theorem, at least in single field slow roll inflation, that the tensor spectral index has to be negative. So that's one thing that we might be able to test someday. Moving on to the scalar mode. The action looks like this. This looks like this almost looks like our previous example of a non-dynamical massless scalar on an FRW spacetime. It's just that instead of a squared here, I have some more complicated time-dependent quantity. By the way, I pulled out the M Planck. I compared to what I wrote before, I put an M Planck squared here and an M Planck squared here. That's just so that this factor would be dimensionless. You can think of this as a nice way to analyze the scalar mode, is to think of it as a non-dynamical scalar, or scalar on a non-dynamical FRW. With a fake expansion history. With the factor of M Planck squared inserted here, this Z is dimensionless. So you can imagine when we analyze the scalar mode having two expansion histories. There's the geometric expansion history A of tau, and then there's this fake expansion history Z of tau, which is going to appear in the equation of motion for the mode function. And there are, for example, just to be careful with notation, you know, there is, for example, a Z Hubble parameter defined as Z dot over Z. Actually, since I'm doing everything in conformal time, I should define it this way. Then there's the geometric Hubble parameter, which uses the real scale factor. So if I use the Z subscript, I mean this version, and no subscript means the A version as usual. So to see how those expansion histories relate, let me expand Z and H sub Z to leading order in slow roll parameters. So here's the definition of Z. If I go to my slow roll dictionary and plug in the expression for phi dot, then I see that to leading order in slow roll, this is two epsilon to the 1/2 times A. And H sub Z, I define like this. If I work that out, my dictionary is all ordinary time derivatives, so I wrote the conformal time derivative as A times D over DT, not Z. The definition of conformal time is with respect to the real expansion history, not the fake expansion history. Then, expand this out. Then I can go to the dictionary and see that this term is larger in the slow roll approximation than the other terms. This guy looks like goes as a slow roll parameter to the 1/2, and these guys involve slow roll parameters to the 3/2. So that term dominates. In this step, I also plugged in the leading slow roll behavior of Z from this line. And I get h over 2 epsilon to the 1/2. So in both the scale factors e and the fake expansion history and its associated Hubble parameter are related to the real expansion history in a simple way. A consequence of this calculation is that at least this is something that is only true to leading order in the Slowborough approximation. But the horizon AH is equal to the Z version, Z times H sub Z. And so that's important because there's only one notion of horizon crossing. So I don't have to notationally distinguish between evaluating some quantity at horizon crossing AH equals K or ZHZ equal to K. Okay. So now we can refer to the non-dynamical FRW background, the massless scalar in the non-dynamical FRW background, and read off the power spectrum of zeta. There's a 1 over m Planck because the action, the way that I wrote it down, had an m Planck squared in front relative to the case of the non-dynamical metric. Then according in the Slowborough approximation, the dimensionless power spectrum is h squared over 4 pi squared, but the h is the h of the fake expansion history. It would also be, you know, more correct to say that this is, strictly speaking, you're evaluating at the time of z horizon crossing. It just that is happens to be equal to the time of a horizon crossing. Okay, and so that is. I should put approximately here because that's just true to leading order in silver. And if I put in this expression for HZ, which is also valid to leading order in slow roll, then I see that this is what I end up measuring when I measure the power spectrum of zeta. So once you go through this analysis, putting in the fake expansion history, it's because there are these, there's this factor relating the fake expansion history to the real one, then the power spectrum of zeta is not, works differently from the gravity waves. The way the gravity waves work is that you are going down the potential, and as you go down, different scales are crossing the horizon, and the gravity wave amplitude is proportional to h squared at horizon crossing. Here there's a factor of 1 over epsilon. And epsilon is always pretty small in the Slowborough approximation, and it can be arbitrarily close to 0. So this can be a big, this could be a potentially be a big factor. Another consequence of this epsilon is that the spectral index can be, of the fluctuations can be either positive or negative. Unlike the cases, the case of the gravity waves or in the non-dynamical case. So so the scalar spectral index now, the definition that would make the most sense would be this. Okay. to parallel the other cases of the gravity wave spectral index NT and the spectral index N that we analyzed in the case of the non-dynamical, the scalar and the non-dynamical background. But for historical reasons, this is defined with a minus one. So this will work out a little differently. Now I'm working out, before I just differentiated log h squared, now I differentiate log h squared over epsilon. And I'm differentiating with respect to log ah since I evaluated horizon cross. So this works out to be I'm going to do a step where I, just like last time, express everything in terms of time derivatives. This guy is 2h dot over h minus epsilon dot over epsilon. This guy is h plus h dot, just like before. And then I go to the slow rule dictionary to leading order in slow roll. Now I should have put an approximately equal to here. This first term is minus 2 epsilon h. And this term is a combination of epsilon and eta in view of the formula for epsilon dot. In this term, h dominates h dot, just like last time, and I get an h to the minus 1. And the final result is minus 6 epsilon plus 2 eta. So for the, now epsilon can be, is always positive in single field slow roll inflation. It's the square of something. But eta could have either sign. So it's possible in inflation for the scalar spectral index to have either sign. Although what's actually observed in the CMB is a negative value. As I suppose you might expect if epsilon and eta were close to each other, just this coefficient is larger and negative. But it doesn't represent a big fine tuning or anything. Okay. So let's talk about how these calculations connect with observations. We haven't observed gravity waves, but of course we have observed the power spectrum of zeta extremely well. That's the main, primordial input into the power spectrum of the CMB. And so one thing that's extremely well constrained is the power spectrum the amplitude of the scalar power spectrum. That's constrained to a few percent. Everything that I say in this next few minutes is going to just be assuming that single field slow roll inflation is the truth, which is a big assumption. I just want to talk about what it would mean under the assumption that single field slow roll inflation is the correct model. What the observations would mean in that context. So there would be one very well measured combination of parameters, h squared over epsilon. But that's hard to interpret on its own. If you put in v for h squared and v prime squared over v squared for epsilon, then you measure the combination of the cube of the potential over the square of its derivative, which is an arbitrary seeming There's one number that's very well measured, but it's sort of an arbitrary seeming combination of physical quantities. Another quantity that's pretty well measured is the spectral index, the scalar spectral index. We have enough. In the CMB, we observe a wide range of scales going from angular multipole 2 to a few thousand. So that's a few orders of magnitude, enough of a lever arm on the power spectrum that we can measure its deviation from scale invariance. And this is observed to have the negative sign. So this combination of slow roll parameters is known to be non-zero at 8 sigma or so. So that means that we see some scale dependence, or we see some evidence for a slope in the power spectrum, some derivative being non-zero, and the evolution of the universe toward the end of inflation. Since inflation has to end, we expect that the potential can't be perfectly flat. That's how the statement can be interpreted. We don't know how much of this deviation from scale invariance is coming from the epsilon versus the eta. So, one scenario might be for many algebraically simple potentials, like an m squared phi squared potential, then it'll sort of generically turn out that epsilon and eta are of the same order of magnitude, and this the deviation from scale invariance is some combination of both. So epsilon might be of order eta here. And but there's also the case, if you consider the case of the inflaton, suppose that at the very beginning of the universe, the inflaton starts on top of a local maximum of its potential, and it rolls off, and the range of scales that we observe in the CMB is very close to the maximum. Then V prime can be very close to zero. That is, epsilon can be made arbitrarily small. And the deviation from scale invariance in this case would be coming from the eta. In this example, the second derivative would be negative, so eta would have the right sign to give the red power spectrum. This might be so-called hilltop scenario, where you still get the red power spectrum and deviation from scale invariance, but epsilon can be very tiny. The next observable is the amplitude of the tensor power spectrum. And this is usually parameterized as R, the tensor to scalar ratio. This will be the number that all the experiments quote this ratio instead of quoting delta H squared directly. Since delta zeta squared is very well measured, there's no real difference. So this turns out to be 16 epsilon. And here we just have a lower limit. Sorry, an upper limit. Which is good enough that it starts, currently good enough that it is putting some pressure on models like this, and perhaps favoring models like this. For example, an m squared phi squared potential is disfavored at a few percent. It's like disfavored at 2.3 sigma or something like that with this upper limit. That's not obvious. You have to integrate a differential equation to see exactly where you are on the potential when you observe our CMB. If I change this exponent to like 1.8 or something, then I can be consistent with the data at 2 sigma. So the current data are something like phi to the fourth is very strongly ruled out. So the data are starting to get constraining and maybe point to models like this. But I would not say that with the current data, a hilltop scenario is decisively favored at high significance or anything. Although, for a long time, there was like a real prejudice in the community toward m squared phi squared being like the model of the early universe. And that seems to not be the case. An important comment is that this can potentially be much better. There's no real fundamental limit, like from cosmic variance or anything like that, to getting down to, say, an R of order 10 to the minus 3 or even smaller than this. Although that statement has been true for a long time, and it's proven to just be very difficult practically to build the experiments. When I finished my PhD in 2007, there were something like 4 or 5 experiments in progress that were hoping to get down, maybe not this low, but maybe to around 10 to the minus 2. In the near future, meaning, say, 3 to 5 years after 2007. And this upper limit actually hasn't changed very much since then. It was more like 0.2 then. I don't remember the exact number. And there was one sort of false detection, as I'm sure you know, where there was this experiment, an experiment by Bicep Keck that claimed to detect R of order 0.2, but later had to revise the measurement as being due to contamination by interstellar dust. So even though the in-principle limit is actually very tiny, and the detector technology exists, the experiments have proven to be very challenging. And even now, in 2017, the same statement is true, that there are many experiments that are in progress that can get down to, in principle, get down to a very low value of R. But we'll see what happens in the next few years. There's a lot of practical challenges that are better understood now. But the history has shown that in achieving this type of value is very practically difficult. To appreciate the difficulty, a signal on the order of R equals 10 to the minus 2 means that you're looking for fluctuations in CMB polarization that are on the order of like a few nanokelvin. And that's on top of a background that is, you know, on the order of 3 Kelvin. So you hope to sort of difference away the background, and there are, you know, dipole fluctuations on the order of 3 millikelvin. There are primary CMB fluctuations on all scales on the order of 100 microkelvin. Dig very deep down into the polarization on large angular scales, subtracting out all of these large signals and trying to subtract out all of the galactic dust that detect something very tiny. And it's just very practically difficult. But I do believe that that the community will get to this value. I would be shocked if it never happened. It's just hard to put a timeline on. So that's certainly one of the improving the value of the error bar in R is certainly one of the more exciting things that we can try to do soon. If R turns out to be measurable, you might think about the different scenarios. So if R is detected, then what are the implications? The whole community got to do a very realistic simulation of this scenario, because there was a window of about 6 months when we all thought it had been detected. And everyone wrote papers about it. So this scenario is nice, because now everything is pinned down. Single field slow roll inflation has three parameters that determine the observables. There's h, epsilon, and eta. And right now we have two measurements in a three-parameter space. So there's one degeneracy, which is the degeneracy shown here, where epsilon is either very small and you have a hilltop model, or epsilon is the same order as eta and you have some more convex-looking potential. All the degeneracies are broken, and one thing in particular that you can determine is the energy scale of inflation. I didn't write this before, but the energy scale of inflation, or the fourth root of its energy density, works out like this. It's by Friedman's equation, it's h squared to the 1/4. And then I'm writing h squared as h squared over epsilon, because that's what's measured. That's the scalar amplitude. Times another factor of epsilon, which I'm pulling out and calling it r. So because this combination of parameters is measured, a nice way to write the energy scale of inflation is like this. And so if r is detected, then whether it's 10 to the minus 3, a very small value, or 0.1, a value that's right on the edge of the current upper limit, doesn't affect the energy scale of inflation very much because of the 1/4 power. Any detectable, realistically detectable value of r can be interpreted as the statement that inflation happens at the gut scale, around 10 to the 16 GeV. If epsilon is small, then inflation happened at a lower energy scale. And that's sort of consistent with the hilltop picture. If inflation happened at a low energy, meaning lower than the gut scale, and then I'm trying to draw a potential that the inflaton rolls down, then of course, you know, I'm going to bump into the ceiling and I have to roll it off. So the hilltop potential doesn't necessarily represent a fine-tuning. The way that I described it, it sounds like you have to fine-tune things. But it always happens. If you always end up with a hilltop if inflation happens at a energy lower than the gut scale. So we would know that inflation happens at the gut scale in this scenario. And we would have measurements of the first two derivatives of V of phi. So we'd have some information, because epsilon and eta would be independently determined. So we'd know the energy scale of inflation, and we'd have two numbers that are telling us something about the shape of the potential. It's really hard to measure third derivatives or higher. Those are terms that are of second order in the slow roll parameters. And that's just because in slow roll inflation, even though we cover everything's evolving slowly, and even though we cover a wide range of multipoles with the CMB, a wide range of physical scales, that only corresponds to a modest range of the inflaton trajectory. So there's just not much of a lever arm in phi space to determine more than two derivatives. But two derivatives would be great. That would certainly be an interesting constraint on high energy physics. And then in this super fun scenario where r is detected, then the next observational target would be nt. If we measure gravity waves, then we can try to measure them over a wide enough range of scale to see wide enough range of scales to see scale dependence in the power spectrum. Single field inflation here would make the prediction that the spectral index that we should see is minus 2 epsilon. And in this scenario, epsilon would be whatever r we measured when we detected the gravity waves over 16. And so there would be some prediction. This relation that if gravity waves are measured with some amplitude r, their spectral index must be minus r over 8. It's called the single field slow roll consistency relation. And it's something that you can try to either verify or falsify to see whether single field inflation is the right theory. In single field slow roll inflation, there are three observables, h, epsilon, and eta. There are three parameters, but there are four observables if you count nt. So there has to be some prediction. The best way to try to measure this, by the way, would be to look for if gravity waves show up in the CMB, they're showing up at some very large cosmological wave length or small scale k, you know, something like inverse gigaparsec. And if you're looking for the scale dependence, the best way to do it is to go out to the CMB and go down to like solar system-like scales where experiment like LISA, a space-based proposed LIGO follow-up, might just directly detect the spectrum of gravity waves, sort of like a factor of 10 to the 16 in wave number. So you'd get a really powerful lever arm and a really precise measurement of NT. If gravity waves are ever measured in the CMB, which would anchor down both the value of the gravity wave power spectrum on cosmological scales and its slope, or at least single field slow roll inflation then would predict the slope, then there would be some target for direct detection experiments to go after. And that would undoubtedly be a big boost to the science that you could do with those experiments. I basically ran out of time. In the opposite scenario, where r is small, like if r is less than, say, 10 to the minus 4, then it's unlikely to ever be detected with cosmology. Well, I don't know. Very hard. With cosmology or the CMB. I don't want to say impossible. And then we'd sort of be stuck. This would point toward a hilltop model of inflation. So there are various ways to say it. One way to say it is that when we measure NS, all of the deviation from scale invariance would then be coming from the eta and none from the epsilon. Or another way to say it is that the energy scale of inflation is below the gut scale by a factor of 10 or more. Whether that's a fine tuning or not is a matter of opinion. I don't personally have an opinion. And it's also possible that in this scenario, maybe inflation is not the right theory. Or alternatives to inflation. I didn't get the chance to talk about them, but as far as I know, maybe there's some counterexample in the literature that I'm not aware of, since theorists are very creative. As far as I know, the alternatives to inflation, such as the ekparotic and cyclic scenario, always have the property that the gravity waves are generated at very low energies. Inflation is the only model where h is large when the fluctuations are generated. And so the gravity wave amplitude, which just measures a bare h with no slow roll parameters or anything else, is always very tiny in these models. If r is observed, then it would really point to inflation as being the theory of the early universe rather than something else. That's all I have, which is good timing. I thought it would be fun at the end to just talk about the connection between the experiments and the theory. Thanks everyone for coming for 15 lectures. There's obviously a lot of early universe stuff that I didn't get to talk about, but that's just like a limitation of a 3-week class. You're gonna do feedback forms. And so the things that are really useful for me to know are sort of like the pace of the class, the pace of the lectures. It's hard for me to tell. Whenever I teach, I always have the sense that like the lectures are locally going really slowly. Like I feel like I'm going really slowly and not covering much in the lectures. But then at the end of the class, when I look back, it seems like I covered just a huge amount of material. We did a bunch of GR stuff, all this early universe physics, the Fisher matrix, et cetera, in 3 weeks. That just seems like a ton of material. So let me know. It's hard for me to tell. The problem sets, like the length, difficulty, are just also can be a little hard to tell and easy to change. And finally, the choice of topics. If you liked or disliked the Fisher matrix statistics stuff, I think it's fun to throw in just for a little variety. Let me know what you think. And also the decision to put computer problems on the homework. OK, thanks, everyone.